of the Kenya Legislative Council. Mr. Maboya speaks now on the search for freedom.
Testing, 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 testing.
You know, last year when we came, your stories was the thing that the kids remembered most.
Yeah?
They really did, yes. And we
I'm
thought...
Glad of that. I'm
yeah,
glad of that.
Yeah, they certainly enjoyed it, didn't they, Mrs. Butler?
They sure did. Uh-huh.
And we would like to ask you some questions, because this is... we feel that this is real history. What
well,
you have to say.
I imagine it will be.
Yeah.
Great history.
Would you tell...
Because of my age. Mm-hmm. Look at my age and no schooling at all.
Would you, just to get it on the record, tell us your name and how old you are?
My name is Ezra Griffin, if you can spell it. And I was born 1858. July the 13th.
Where were you born?
Well, it was called then Smithville. It's now called Big Indian.
Big Indian.
Yeah, between Big Indian and Pine Hill in a log cabin. Mm-hmm. So my folks said that. I don't know. I don't remember.
You don't remember?
I don't remember nothing.
What was the first thing that you can remember?
The settling of the Civil War.
How did you hear about that?
Well, it came through by a man on horseback. Came through the mountain, up through the mountain roads. Mm-hmm. The same road that you go up into Woodland Valley, but you went right on through to Delhi. Mm-hmm. That was the end of the road at Delhi.
Mm-hmm. And a man came through and told
on horseback and gave the news. Uh-huh. Well, then the blacksmith was only a little ways apart. And they got the anvils together, see, and they put one anvil on top of the other, and there's a hole in each one.
Uh-huh.
Well, they turned the holes up and filled it with powder, you know. Put a little powder along back out here and had a long stick with a little match on it. Put that boiling candle go in the air and make a great noise. Like a cannon.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And you were a little boy then?
I was a little, 3 months. Mm-hmm. Just remember it. That's all I can remember of it.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember your grandparents?
Oh, yes. Well, very well. I used to go down and have Grandfather Smith carrying wood into his woodshed so he'd have seen wood the year round, as he's called it. Grandmother was in the kitchen.
Did she spin?
Eh?
Did she do any spinning of...
Well, now, I won't say she did or didn't. Mm-hmm. I don't just remember that. But I think she did, because I think everybody had a spinning wheel, and reel, as they called it. And they made flax. They hammered flax, but I never saw that. At all, but I've seen the machine.
Uh-huh. Now, just to get it on the record, your grandfather, do you know when he was born?
Oh, no.
Now,
He was born in Holland.
He was?
Yes, sir.
And do you know how old he was when he came to this country?
No, sir, I do not.
Or how old he was when you knew him?
Well, he was quite an old man when the last I knew of him. He died with the hiccups. Was all by his bedside.
When you were a boy, what were the kind of games they used to play?
None. Baseball and babble. Mm-hmm. And pitching plays with stones. And jumping. Have stones in your hand and jump with stones. See which could jump the furthest. That was the game.
Would the boys do any hunting?
Very little, because we were a little too small.
Do you remember?
The old folks done the hunting. Mm-hmm. They'd go out in wintertime when the snow was deep, trust on it and go and get a sleigh load of deer and bring in the meat. It was a sight, and that's all I can remember of that.
You remember them bringing in the sleigh loads of deer?
Sleigh load of deer, yeah. Uh-huh. They killed him with a club.
Do you remember what school was like?
What
or
school?
You didn't go to school, did you?
Oh, yes. I didn't go till I was 8 years old. Then I know most of the multiplication table. I could read a little bit and spell pretty good.
Mm-hmm. And what was the school like?
Well, I couldn't say whether it was anything more than just a natural classes come and go to the seats to come out and say their lessons. Read their lessons or spell their lessons or repeat it.
Do you remember any of your teachers?
Well, a few of them, yes.
Which one do you remember best?
Well, now I had Sally Mark, her name was Sally Morley. And the next one I had was Wren Van, lived in Hawkett. The next one I had, I think, was Palmer. And I liked Sally the best of the three at that time.
Uh-huh.
And I left school at 11. I went to school at 8. At the first I could get in. The school house was small and the district was big. And it was just settling and there was just young people coming in and settling. And there were so many children coming in.
Do you remember any of the things that people would do just to entertain themselves? Did they ever have dances or anything
that?
Could you remember what they were like?
Well, there was the old dances or all kinds of dances, waltzes and so forth. Square dance, fireman's dance, the old dad's reel as they used to call it.
Uh-huh.
They had all those dances. But you had to go good ways to get to those buildings that was big enough for it.
Mm-hmm.
We used to go around with apple cut nights in the apple orchard in the afternoon, pick up our apples at night and have an apple cut. Well, they'd come and peel them apples and cut them and slice them, mullins, and dry them the next day or whoever had the house.
See, they'd all get together and help each other peel and cut these apples. And then they put them on big frames and dry them?
Yeah.
And then what would they do with them after they're dried?
They put them in a sack and hang them in the garret where it's dry.
See, that was a way to preserve the apples for the winter.
And preserve the dried, what we call dried apples. Mother used to make applesauce, apple pie.
And there'd be a lot of people around cutting apples together, and then would afterwards then would they dance?
And afterwards, well then the fiddler, he'd come in and then they'd have a dance.
Uh-huh.
Dance maybe up to 12 o'clock and then they'd all go home.
You said, the other time we were here, you said something about the first time that railroad came through there. You remember that?
Yes.
What was that like?
I don't know. I can't just explain it. It was a surprise. It was quite a sight to see a steam car come through there. We hadn't heard much of it before it got through. And the engine that they had on to draw the gravel and stuff and ties and rail, old Nancy, I think they called it. And she jumped track every little while and jumped back on again. Kept going. Well, may I say a few words?
Whatever, yes.
Well, it's quite a school. We had six. The odd from one teacher daily.
60.
Yeah. The register run up to 91.
And how big?
But they weren't all there at that one any one day. Uh-huh. But the register run up to 61 on right through. So you can see we had quite a little spot in that. And now today it's comparatively about all done but a few houses gone. There's only a few houses left. Well, children, I don't know how old you are, but remember, It's a year what?
Seven.
What year is it?
1960.
Oh, 1960. Well, where will you be a year from this very day? And what will you be doing? Be doing something good for your country.
Could you tell us something about the oxen and how they trained the oxen?
Yeah, they put a yoke on to them. They put a yoke on to them, decided them to go, let them go. When they stopped, they'd holler, whoa. When they went to go on again, they'd holler, get up. They found out the words. They broke easy, but they were small, you know. The others, they all broke them when they were yearlings to the yoke. Took a rope on the near one next to you, and we travel along that way. Oh, the oxen broke very nice. I had a pair of Debbie's shears. They were a pretty pair. You could hardly tell one from the other. Round as apples. Why, they're pretty pair.
Didn't you help your father build a cabin, build a house, a log house or something?
No, not a log house, not a cabin. Uh-huh. I helped them in this way. I worked on the railroad when I got old enough. And my wages went in for them to build a boarding house, small boarding house on the little house they had there, together. Finally they got into quite a business and they've done pretty good. I helped you see one that. Mm-hmm. That's where I got to. When I got married, well, I started off alone by myself. I'm here alone today.
Mm-hmm. What was the thing you worked at the most of your life?
Why, the longest of anyone spell was a carpenter work.
Carpenter work.
19 years. Building houses, feed houses, storehouses, barns.
When you were young, were there still any Indians around?
No.
They were all gone already.
Yeah. The old fellow that used to steal the neighbor's pigs and chickens, he was way down towards Shandaken. Mm-hmm. And there was a big holler tree. Well, the tree was a button ball. And he worked out quite a door into it with stone. He lived in there.
He lived in the tree?
Yeah, he lived inside the tree. Mm-hmm. Well, they kept missing their chickens and their pigs. Well, they couldn't imagine where they were going. So one time there come a little fall of snow. He left his tracks. Mm-hmm. They followed his tracks back and found. And then they killed him. That is, as near as I know, I don't know who killed him, but how they killed him.
Mm-hmm. Where did you hear that story?
Well, at home.
I see.
Right there in the little hamlet where we live.
Uh-huh. Did you ever hear any stories of witches or goblins or anything like that?
Oh, yeah, witches churning. Witches getting a churn, couldn't churn, butter wouldn't come. They throw a red hot horseshoe in, out come the butter.
Well, what would the horseshoe do?
Well, red hot. The cream was cold, the butter couldn't uh-huh. congeal.
But I suppose they thought it killed the witch,
and
huh?
That killed the witch. Yeah. Kids, you'll have a wonderful time filling out everything. Mm. Do I go too fast for you?
No.
All right. This fellow here is lazy, I think, don't you?
He takes care of the machine.
I think he's lazy. He's got to lay down and hold his head on his hand. Shall I go get this fella?
Were there any good storytellers around that used to amuse people with their stories and jokes?
Oh, yes. The man that called Rosecrans tells me stories about his hunting.
Do you remember any of the stories?
I remember one story about his going hunting after a deer. Well, he started grasped the deer and the skeeter kept going around a knoll like all the while. He kept following them around. He got tired chasing the deer, so he took his gun up to a tree and walked the bear around the tree. And he went on around, and when he shot, well, the bear was turned the other way and he shot the deer.
The barrel shot right around the corner.
Yes, right around the...
Did you know this man, Rosencrantz?
Oh, I've seen him. I remember hearing him talk. He's got a funny old talker.
Uh-huh.
Quite a big man. And we used to go up to Olive Reed, now Slide Mountain, go up that way, go up to the old Slide Mountain. 4 or 5 of us go up and stay overnight, about a day and 2 nights. We used to have quite a lot of sport around.
That's the highest mountain of all, isn't it, the Slide Mountain?
In the Catskills.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, you look down on quite a good many of the others. I'm high at that. Wittenberg with Cornell, Panther, and one way up in Stanford. You look right off on that. The high peak of Stanford. I don't just remember the name of it now. My memory is going.
Well,
and we used to, in the winter time, log. Go in the woods and cut the trees down and draw the logs out and pick up the sawmill.
In those times, did you live back in the woods or did you go home at night?
Oh, we were in the little places where we cleared the, my folks cleared off, and they had a little lean-to. I think it was 20 by 20. It was a story and a half frame. And then they had a lean-to on the back. That's where father and mother, there was a bedroom in there. And we slept up in the little half roof.
Mm-hmm. Well, did you have a ladder to go up there?
Yeah.
No stairway,
right,
just a ladder.
Right straight up the ladder was. You lay right in the kitchen.
Was it cold?
You raised a hand and hold your feet good.
Yeah,
all in.
And what was the bed like?
Well, the bed was all right. We had a straw tick, called a straw tick, a dry straw into it, good and heavy, it helped that thick. You get in, you roll around, and around, nice, just nice thick.
Was it cold up there?
No. And then we built a little addition onto it. I think the length of the lean-to and the house together, and that gave us a front room. Oh, it's pretty as big as this room here. That's about as big as we used to put on. Then we had a couple of bedrooms downstairs and 2 of them. That gave us quite a lot of room.
Do you remember when the first automobile came through?
Well, I remember hearing them telling about it, but I wasn't out.
Uh-huh.
We had horses. Father and mother, they happened to be out, went to Pine Hill to do some trading. And they heard they was coming, they went across the creek there in Smithville, got over in the meadow, Gossip Meadow, the pasture, waited till they go out and went by. Trade the horses, you know, to New England. Get scared. They did scare a lot of horses. First car went through, one cylinder. Bang, bang, bang. So they said, I don't know, I didn't hear it. And it hit. And it kept growing. We used to go trout fishing, get some nice methods of trout. Speckled trout, native trout. The stream then was full of minnows, mudsuckers, horned aces and all that. Now you can't see one in the creek. The last time I was fishing up in the mountains there, and in the big stream, the small stream, couldn't see a minnow. Not a sucker of any kind except the silver tip. He was about that long. You never see small trout in the mouth. And they put in German browns and they clean put near the brook trout. There they are. They're not much fishing anymore.
Did you ever see a bear in the mouth?
Yes, sir, and I'd helped to kill four. Well, I was quite a hunter after I got grew up. In the wintertime when I was off the railroad, I'd hunt. I killed four bears, only four, along one winter. I'd run one 3 days.
You just follow it for 3 days?
Well, we didn't follow them, the dogs followed them. Mm-hmm. But now you can't follow them with a dog.
Why?
You can't hunt them with a dog now.
You're not allowed to?
No. We could hunt with dogs, we could do anything else. My time up there, and last I got, maybe 45, 50 years old, and then we're going to make new laws, make an amendment up in the House, an amendment, voted in. That's the way the laws come in, it's in of the present day.
When you finally got up to the bear, did they put up any fight or anything?
We never got very close to him. We always hit him down with lead.
Uh-huh.
I had what they call the Springfield rifle, 38-40, 15 shots without reloading. All they had to do was just to pump it. I got so I could pump my head in pretty close. I never fooled on anything very in any reasonable distance of what I got.
Do you remember a hunter named Mike Todd?
Mike Todd?
Yeah.
Mike Todd.
He lived up in Dry Brook.
Well, I didn't know what Todd lived up in there. I didn't know just what his name was.
A lot of Todds up there.
Well, I think he's Regional Todd's father. Regional Todd is up in there now.
He's
up farming on the account of rheumatism, I understand. I'd awfully like to see, go up and see him, but I ain't got the strength. Can't just go through.
Now, would you youngsters, would any of you like to ask any questions? Maybe by you have, yes, Johnny?
What kind of a bear was it?
Black bear.
Did you ever?
Red nosed bear.
Did you ever kill a grizzly?
A what?
A grizzly bear.
Oh no, I never went out of Ulster County for the hunt. The mountain.
See, here they didn't have any grizzly bears.
There's no grizzly bears here, you gotta go way off.
Any other questions?
In other countries. Where they inhabit.
Danny?
Well,
When did you start farming?
When did I stop farming?
Start.
Start farming?
Yeah.
Well, I think it was 1911. We left the city and went up on the farm.
Fall?
Why did you want a farm?
Well, my brother-in-law died. He was running the farm. My mother-in-law was alone. So she came down and wanted me to go up and take the farm and boarding house together. That's the way I come to go back up on the farm.
Paul?
What did you think the future was going to be when you were a boy?
What?
What did you think the future was going to be when you were a boy? Like, what I think the future was going to be.
Like you are?
Yeah.
Well, all right, now, here's, I'll ask you, what do you think you're going to be?
Well, I don't know.
Well, I couldn't tell you. I had no idea what my future would be. My future has been very, very nice. I've been through the world for quite a long time, and I never suffered very much of any sickness or anything like that to mountain. Well, all right, what is it?
Yes, Anita?
What did you use the fur for from the bear?
What did you use the bear skin for?
Why, we sold it. We sold the bear skin, same as fox skin, same as coon skins, skunk skins. Inventory. Sometimes we didn't smell too good, and sometimes we were all right.
Yes?
Did any of your relatives fight in the Civil War?
Any of your relatives fight in the Civil War?
Why, yes. Father-in-law.
Did they ever have any stories to tell when they came back?
They'd never tell anything.
They wouldn't?
No, they're like the boys who come back from World War I, they wouldn't tell you anything.
What's that?
That's my fear, is that they could buy them off, they could buy themselves off at that time.
Yeah. Was he in the war?
No, he wasn't.
No, no.
You weren't in the war?
Oh, no. I had two boys.
Two boys in Eden?
No,
that's...
Two boys in the war.
Oh, yes.
First World War and Second World War, the boy was... This young boy went to the Second War, using the two wars. Then the boy is in Liberty now.
You tell them that so you could buy yourselves off in those days.
You could buy yourself off from going to war?
So I understood. Now I don't know. I understood the question. I don't know. I know Father didn't go, and he was entitled to go. Mm-hmm. And there was one fella wouldn't go. He said, ashes from the fire. Steel dust in his eyes so he couldn't see, you know. And it made him blind. He didn't think it was going to finish him. He'd be blind, but it blinded him entirely. He done that so he wouldn't have to go to war. He lived to be quite an old man, too. Name of Hinckley. Now, is there any more questions you
want? Any other questions?
I used to go hunting coons at night. I killed 26, one fall, one dog. I only had to shoot one. The rest of them were killed with a club. I had the gun, but I didn't like to make their hide bloody. Sell by the gun, get no more than 50 cents for two knives. Now I guess you get $78 for one.
Did you ever get caught out in the cold weather in a blizzard or anything like that?
Why, I was in the 88.
Oh.
We was pinned in there for a couple of days.
What was that like?
Well, it was like cold weather. You know what cold weather is? It was cold weather, I'm telling you. You walked right along at what we call the dugway, and in that dugway was a little cold. Well, there was shoemix in there, and they had a lot of buds on them. Well, the birds had come to earth. They were in there feeding on those shoemix, see? Dropping right down in the snow. We thought, get their stomachs full, and you'd have to go down the snow. Be all right. Well, the next day we went down, went up there and investigated, and there they were all frozen to death.
How deep was the snow?
Oh, God. Some places to 25 feet, some places to not, and some places to 3-4. But the regular fall of snow where it laid still was about 28 inches, near as I remember.
How many feet?
28 inches.
Did,
2 feet and what?
28 feet. Oh, 8 inches. 8 inches. 2 feet, 4 inches.
Get it right now. How much weight is it? 2 feet and what?
4 inches.
2 feet and 4 inches.
The drifts were 25 feet.
Some places were 25 feet
where it drifted. And that was especially in the road where we couldn't get out.
And you couldn't get to town?
No.
Did you have enough food?
Oh, yes, we had plenty of food. The only trouble we had was the water from the tap. The snow drifted in the creek, and it was all wet. There was no water. We didn't dare let them out and get in there and get full fat, so we kept them in the stable and carried water to them, in pails.
Yes, John?
Did you hunt any other kind of animals besides raccoons?
Yes, skunks.
No, you know, like rabbits.
Rabbits, yes. Woodchuck, squirrel, anything that had to pop up, down and hunting, why you had to go down. We were good shots. Very seldom missed. I took a young fella in, about like this fella, maybe. Or one of them, these boys. He wanted me to go with him. Gray squirrel hunting. Well, he couldn't go, you know. His father couldn't go. Couldn't get no permit to go. So I went down to the, I wrote down, I called down to the county town clerk next. Well, he says, the old game warden comes around telling me, send your boy on, let him go on away from you, don't be hunting around with him, so I had him hunting around with you, tell him go on. So he went with me. And I shot a chipmunk, he jumped up on the stomach, you know, and said, tit-tit-tit-tit-tit-tit. And I shot it. He couldn't find me. All that was left of him was his eyes way off over and it bright. That's so close on to him.
I understand that there were a lot of these big estates where you couldn't go fishing and they were had some trouble with poachers.
Oh, that has been naturally long ever since I can remember almost. But we never posted the streams up there until after the crook shanks got in. Then he posted his whole 1,400 acres. But they'd go and fish on somebody else.
Posting means that they put signs up saying no fishing or hunting allowed. And nobody could go in there. And some people did that, and then the local people didn't like that at all because that meant that they were deprived of their opportunity to fish and hunt. Sometimes they would go in and, at night and what they called poaching and just do it illegally.
And then they got guns that they put on the muzzle of the end of the barrel. Silence. Couldn't hear no one shoot. Shoot just the same. You wouldn't hear no sound at all. The mountains and then it sort of a pop right by you. Oh, they done everything with that.
I understand this house here is quite an old house.
Oh, very.
We've been interested in the old stories of slavery days. Do you know whether there were slave quarters in this house? There weren't.
I don't know any more.
Uh-huh.
I haven't been here and I've known this place what, since 1900, about 1900. Then the daughter and the husband went to have come around the house and we lived way downtown. That's all.
Well, are there any other questions? This has been very interesting, and we're very glad we have the tape because we can take it back with us and play it. Would you like to hear your own technician take over?
Testing.
Just, I'm aware of the fact that this tape is going back with us, and when we play it, we will remember this evening. Just a few minutes ago, I took the girls on a pickup truck, and we drove to the top of a knoll where we could see the sky just filled with stars, as someone said, just like the planetarium, and it was very beautiful. But one of the good things about this trip is that in addition to seeing the mountains and really getting a wonderful feeling of the mountains at night, we can also meet people. And people are the important part
of our trip. We are going to hear something now about the science of archaeology. You know, we think that our history books can tell us about the past, but there's so much that we still don't know about the past. And for many, many years, people knew that you go to Greece and Rome and you dig for ancient civilizations, but for a long time people never realized that there's a lot of digging to be done right around here. I was talking a few minutes ago to Mr. Burgraff about an old fort that's near here, an old Revolutionary War fort. Now, what's left of it is underground. And if you took a shovel and dug in the right place, you'd come up with some, maybe a musket, maybe some bullets, maybe some buttons from an old uniform. But all around, there are things to be learned through digging in the ground. And we have a man who lives here in the community who works at building things up, building new things during the day. He's works at construction work, but he has a hobby of archaeology. And I think that it's much more than a hobby. He really is very experienced at it. I pointed out to you at Hurley the area where before the Hurleyites, the present-day Hurleyites, raised corn there, the Indians had their cornfields and their villages. Mr. Burgraff has done some digging there. And I asked him at first, so you understand something about archaeology, to make a drawing to show how this, how you dig down in the earth to find out things. And I'm very happy to introduce now Mr. Jim Burgraff.
Did they see the actual site?
No, not the actual site, just the general fields around there.
Well, see that you saw the Kingston Flats, right?
Yes.
Now, those Kingston Flats, that was the real center of the Esopus Confederacy, the northern branch of the Delaware Indians. They, when the Dutch came here, they farmed most of those flats. Well, they didn't farm it all at once. They farmed a place here until the ground ran out, and then they burned off the trees on another place and farmed that. But they must have been doing that for a good many centuries before the white man came. But we found out by digging that that was recent stuff, because men had been living on that high ground around those flats above the creek for at least 3,000 to 4,000 years. We were very fortunate. There was a small bit of land preserved between the flats themselves and present Route 209 that was almost untouched. It was the last portion of a large Indian village that had once lay on all that high ground overlooking the flats from south of Kingston into Old Hurley Village. By digging test holes, we were able to find out that we were getting Indian relics as far down as 35 inches underground. It was kind of hard to figure out why that was at first, but we soon came to the conclusion that originally that field had been level and it dropped off right into the creek in that manner there. But up here there's a high hill, and every time you'd get a fire or something would burn off the trees through the centuries, you'd get heavy rains in the spring or even during the summer, and a little bit of sand had washed down, keep down washing over. If an Indian had lived here way back 4,000 years ago, he'd gone away sometime after he left, a layer of sand had washed over his head, over his where he lived before. So we had a constant level, one right on top of the other. You'd have a pit way down into the original glacial sand, a few inches above it, you'd have another pit going down into the same level. You'd have burials, you'd have a perfect sequence, one above the other. But unfortunately, it was only an area that was preserved for perhaps 180 feet long by 50 feet wide. Because that there wash has been continuing ever since. Every time they plow that field there, the soil keeps washing down. So now instead of this here hill being level like this, it slopes up here. This whole portion here is gone. In fact, that was how I first found that site there. Every time they were plowing down here, they were plowing up bits of human bone. They were cutting into burials. The burials had been buried on that level there, and now they're, as the soil washed down, they were cutting into these graves. A test hole over there, immediately where the bones were turning up, I located two burials there, and one was completely destroyed already. The plow was cutting through it each time they plowed. See, each year, they plant that field of corn. During the winter, it would wash down and get about an inch lower. Next time they plowed, the plow always cuts the same depth. They cut into a new strata. And finally, they destroyed this whole forward edge of the field. But the back edge had been buried so deep through the centuries with soil that there was a lot in there. And I'll show you some of the material came from there.
You said something about test holes. What is that?
Yeah, well, we just dig through the... You see, that field had been plowed. So the first 12 inches of that soil had been turned up by the plow every year. But so we dug right through that plowed area into the subsoil to see if there was anything below there. Well, and almost immediately we hit one of these pits. Now they show as a black oval in the ground. In Indian days, they dug out in that clear sand, they dug a pit. They heated it up and they stored their corn in it in the wintertime. In the springtime, when they'd eaten all the corn up and the snow went off, they cleaned up their village and all the garbage, all the refuse of the village would be dumped into that hole there. And they'd dig another one the next year. So those are natural, even though they're refuse, they're a natural repository for all sorts of things that would be lost. You get perfect arrow points, you get broken pottery. And quite often, in the bottom of those same pits, if an Indian died during the winter, there was a ready-made grave. They'd bury him right in the bottom and cover him over. They didn't have to dig a new grave. When you figure, it was quite a chore to even to dig in sand, because they had to dig with hoes made out of stone or with their hands. So they usually picked a place that was pretty easy digging. And this field was very fortunate. It was beautiful, clear, gray glacial sand underneath with a red burnt-looking sand on top. Now here's one of the residents of that site. This was part of a burial, two burials right together, a male and a woman. But this is a skull we preserved. Contrary to belief that Indians have perfect teeth, this had very poor teeth. Now that Indian didn't have an awful good life, because sometime quite early in its life it lost all its lower teeth. That showed it nutritional deficiency, most likely scurvy and a very bad winter starvation. And that Indian had lost in its youth, it lost all its back teeth on the bottom, you see. The upper teeth here are very long because they had nothing opposing them. See, that tooth there grew out because it had nothing to grind on. Usually, now the front teeth here, you'll see they're ground almost flat because they ate such coarse food. If they ground corn, they ground it with stone and it'd have all sand in it. All their food was coarse. Their teeth are worn right off. You don't see nice, perfect teeth on any Indian. You don't see it on any savage people, for that matter. The ancient Egyptians the same way. You get a very old, old person, their teeth are only a fraction of an inch long. There are none left. And here we'll show you a little bit of the material comes out of those. Now on this site, the very first Indian was a hunter. He lived entirely by hunting and food gathering. By food gathering we mean he'd eat anything that he could eat, and some things that we probably wouldn't turn our nose up at. He'd eat snails, they'd eat snakes, or if you're hungry, you'll pretty near eat anything. And they were expert hunters. I doubt very much that a fellow wasn't, in those days, wasn't a good hunter. He didn't live very long, because he had to go and get meat every day. And that forced them also to be nomadic. They'd travel. As soon as they cleaned the game out of one spot, they'd just pick up the camp and move to another. Later on, as Indians increased more and more, the population increased, new Indians came in from the west, migrations, new bands come perhaps straight from Siberia, coming across the continent. It got harder and harder for the population to live entirely on animals. So we'll find them more and more eating stuff like freshwater clams, which they never touched before. They were so unpalatable. But luckily, about that time, some 3,000 years ago, corn came in. Somewhere from the southwest, they learned to raise corn instead of just depending on going out and gathering hickory nuts and ground nuts and anything that they could save for the winter. They ate a lot of acorns, incidentally. They found that they could go and raise corn, store it, and one of their chief worries was removed. They had food for the future. Then you find them staying in one spot longer and longer. Now, the later Indians on this very site, that would be the direct descendants, ancestors of the Delaware. In their pits, we find a lot of charred corn, showing that that was an important article of their diet. And then immediately you'll find very, very little bone, practically no deer bone, no bear. So they lived on a vegetable diet more than anything, but it was all right. When they had a chance, when their crops were in, they mostly went up to the mountains, like this type of country here. And then you'll find them in the caves where they lived when they were hunting. You'll find that they did kill a great many deer and bear. They had a regular field day. But most of their life, in the last 1,000 years around here, they lived mostly on corn and beans and with whatever wild food they could get. Now here, the very first man that lived in this part of the country, came in here about 7,000 years ago. Around 7,000 years ago, the last of the last ice age, the fourth ice age, had gone. Before that, everything here was covered with a sheet of ice. You'll see the marks on the rocks, you'll see the long grooves cut. Man already had been living in the southwest, south of where the ice never reached. He'd been living as much as 25,000 years ago. He came over from Asia. But as the ice sheet went north, melted, the land became warmer, the southwest became dry, and game got scarce there, and you find the Indians moving across the continent, always in pursuit of game. Eventually, about 7,000 years ago, they reached New York State. At that time, of course, there were very, very few of them. They were hunters, that's all they did. They had no bows, they had no arrows. They didn't even throw this spear, they used a hand lance. And they're typified by this type of point. They're not an ancient Stone Age man because they were highly developed already. That apparently when they left Asia, they were real skilled in working flint. But their lance points are always noted for this fluke driven out through the middle. It would fit right on like that. And they'd only thrust with it. Of course, they got their game by deadfalls, pitfalls. They'd hunt them at night with lights, with flares, and most likely they had domesticated dogs to help them hunt. They were very good at it because they seemed to survive very well. Later on, other bands kept coming in. One big gigantic migration came in along the Great Lakes. We call them the Laurentians. They had an entirely different type of spear point. They're always typified by this. They had a notches in their spears. They would fasten like that and they'd bind it on this way. They couldn't pull off. They kept coming in for over 1,000 years, moving mostly along the shores of the Great Lakes and down the Hudson Valley into this country, in this territory here, and they spread out along the coast. Later on, still other bands would come in. Some migrations came up the coast. They must have gone across the whole United States and hit the coast way down, we'll say, in the Carolinas, and they worked up. Gradually, they merged with these Indians here and most likely they were the what became the Delaware later. Because the last stronghold of them was, we'll say, on Long Island. You'll find pottery and points, spear points and arrow points that are very recent, and yet they're this ancient type, this type here. And the pottery has a pointed bottom. It's a very crude sort of a pot. And yet that survived on Long Island up until the time the white man came. Up here we were subject to a lot of pressure was gradually brought on these Indians around here by the invasion of a very fierce type of Indian, the Iroquois. He come in from the shores of the St. Lawrence, gradually worked down and killed off anyone that opposed him, and those he didn't kill, he subjugated. These Indians around here, they were only allowed to live by paying tribute to the original racketeers, the Mohawk, which was the nearest of the Iroquois to them. And from them, they learned the habit of making their arrows in little triangles. Now that arrow would be fastened onto a shaft like that and was only lightly bound around here, and around here. Now that arrow would go into game or a person. If it was pulled out, that piece would stay in. And that was so effective in the hands of the Iroquois, I guess, that the local Indians copied it. And this is the last type of point you'll find used around here. The Indian was completely in the Stone Age. He had no metals. If he did have any metal at all, it was a little bit of copper he'd pick up along the shores of the Lake Superior and trade it over here. Sometimes, even in the soil here, you get a piece of copper brought down by the glaciers. But everything else was made of stone. They made the blades for their tomahawks were just a stone, fit right into a war club like that. Their other, for cutting heavy, breaking up wood, they use a crude thing like this with a groove around it. And this would have a handle right around it to break up their firewood. That, of course, was very important to them because in this kind of climate, you can't survive unless you've got wood to burn. You know it right over here now. They wouldn't go and take this and cut down a live tree with it. If they knew they were going to go on a village site, a new place, as much as 2 years before, they'd go and just take this and cut the bark around a tree and kill the tree. 2 years later, the tree would be dead. Then, instead of going to all the trouble of chopping the tree down, you just build a fire of old branches around it and burn it down. And then, instead of cutting, like we do, cutting the firewood up into lengths, you merely take the big whole log, as much as you can drag, and you feed it into the fire constantly. And it's very much simpler. Right through the hole, ladies. Now, if you want to feed this fire here, you just go and take a log right through there and poke one end in the fire there. And every time it burned off, you just push it forward. And it was quite simple. But yet they even that way, they went and killed off an awful lot of trees. That's what the chief reason why Indian villages kept moving from spot to spot. They had no more firewood. They dig with stone hoes. Here's all the stone hoe would be. Just tipped on a low ridge. But just like a present day hoe. And with them they'd cultivate their corn. There's nothing to it. Sometimes they'd use a shoulder blade of a deer. If sometime, perhaps, you'll have a chance to go up to the big flint mine at Cooksackie, north of here. And that is where they mine their flint to make their arrow points. And if you ever go up there, it'll be quite a sight. For at least 5,000 years, Indians have been going there before the white man came and producing a type of blade like this. He makes this here, just chips it at the site. First he quarries a piece of flint out of the ledge, and then he chips it into a blade like this. And then he takes this away with him. Maybe he'd make in one season by stopping at that village, at that mine up there, he'd make perhaps 200 or 300 of these. He'd take them way back as far as Massachusetts. And from that, it's very simple to go and make this. You see one of these like this that's the ancestor of this. You just take two notches out of there and just point it up and you've got it. You've got a spear point. So they knew if they could get this far, they could go the rest of the way and make that. Sometimes many of your folks are furriers. They still use a knife similar to this here for cutting fur. Here's one made out of slate with just the edge ground. It was used exactly as a present-day furrier's knife, most likely for the same purpose, cutting leather. This comes from Hurley, the same site here. They had arrow points take all sorts of shapes. You see these little ones, sometimes they're very tiny. The purpose of an arrow point is to, if it hits a bone, a skull, or anything of an animal, it'll punch through. It's very hard. It's one of the hardest substances known. It's made using native flint. Occasionally, when they didn't have a piece of flint, they'd make it out of a piece of white quartz, which is also very hard. If you lived on Long Island and you ever collected any arrowheads, you'll find down there they're all made of that because they had no flint, because it's all glacial moraine down there. I thought tonight we'd go even beyond the Indian period. We'd go into the white man's occupation here. Of course, white man has lived here or visited here since, we know, 1609. That's when Hudson came up the Hudson River, and at the same time Champlain was going down Lake Champlain. And from that point on, the Indian was doomed. Of course, the white man wanted his land. Just within less than 100 years, there were practically no Indians left here. So all our history, 7,000 years of Indian, and we've gone now about 350 years of white man. So I'll have out in the car a few items you might see of early white man's. I'll bring them in. At New York in about 1624. Actually, all they had was permission from the English to wooden water at the port of where New York is. But they thought it was a pretty good chance to make a grab, and they went and established permanent settlements there. Well, it didn't set very well with the British, because they claimed the entire coast from Massachusetts right down to Virginia as a result of Captain John Smith's early voyages along this coast. They let the Dutch sit here until 1664, and when the Dutch were rather weak at home, they sent a fleet here and they took it over and claimed it for Great Britain. It became a British colony from then on. There was a little brief period when the British fleet went away and the Dutch tried to reclaim their possessions here. But practically from 1664 on, it was an English colony. We had, at that time, the French had also settled north of here into Canada. They boldly claimed all the way down here too. Everybody's claims overlapped those days. As much as you could grab was the order of the day. There was constant warfare between the French and the English, both on their side of the water and over here. The trouble spilled over here. On this side, most of it consisted of Indian fighting. The French in Canada would hire or bribe Indians to go and fight on their side, and the British would use chiefly the Iroquois up in northern New York as their fighters. And of course, anybody that got in their way, white man, either side, was just too bad, because the Indian wasn't very particular who he scalped. That went on until what we call the French-Indian War, 1758, 59, 60, 61. And at that time, French were so decisively beaten that in Canada that they ceded all this land, Canada right south, to the British also. Now we have, in that period, here is a powder horn dated 1759. Now these horns were carried by troops from around here. They were usually called Rangers. They were sort of a early commando. They travel light, They usually carried a Kentucky rifle or a musket, and they traveled, they raid way up into Canada. They lived very much like the Indians. In fact, they scalped as often as an Indian did. They'd scalp their men, their victim. It didn't make much difference if it was a Frenchman or an Indian when he met him. Those were the real pioneers around here. And they could live off the woods about as good as an Indian. They'd live on game, and they'd just carry a supply of powder and ball, extra gun flints, and their weapons. Now here, this is the powder horn which they'd carry their powder in. The strap would go around here and a strap here and would carry right against their side. That's why most of the figures are worn off on this horn. They fired, when they used a musket, they fired around about a 1 ounce ball of lead. That's the size of it. It was quite inaccurate in a musket, but as I say, many of these men used a Kentucky rifle which had rifling in it and was much more accurate. And they also carried a tomahawk, exactly like an Indian, an iron tomahawk. And they went and they protected our frontier. Men right from this part of the country would often join the Rangers and fight along the Great War Path, along Lake George, Lake Champlain, up that way, on the principle of keeping the enemy as far away from us as possible. Eventually they, as I say, they beat the French, and then the English immediately claimed all that valley up there, and that, as soon as that war was over, the settlements spread out along Lake George, Lake Champlain, up that way. But still, as late as the Revolution, all beyond the upper Mohawk Valley was still Indian country. And here, we fought the English in the Revolution, and their allies still were the Iroquois. They still fought on their side. They did not go over to the American side. And that was an excellent excuse for us to go and seize all the Indian country as far west as the Great Lakes. We sent an expedition which fitted out right, a good part of it fitted out right here at the Shandaken Fort, the Sullivan Expedition. Men from right here all got together. They marched over Peekamoose Mountain down into what is now Sundown, and from there they rendezvoused at Oquaga, way on the Susquehanna River. And from there they joined another batch of men coming up from Pennsylvania. They went through the present site of Cortland and Elmira, New York, and they kept on vanquishing the Indians. And they burned all their corn. And on that basis, they claimed all of what is present New York State for the American colonies, from the American, the new nation, the United States, mostly New York State. And that land after the Revolution was given out to the soldiers as a bounty for their service. Each one would get 100 acres or so. This here particular horn was used not around here. This was used in Maine, in the Massachusetts Bay Colony, during the Revolution. This horn is larger than an ordinary one, and it's interesting in that you can unscrew the top and fill it with powder from the top here, like a funnel. The reason for this was, this horn was an artilleryman's horn. If you ever seen pictures of them firing cannons, you'll see they're holding, looks like a stick in their hand. They'd load that cannon with powder, put a cannonball in the muzzle, and then the gunner, which would be this man, he'd pour a mound of powder over the touch hole, a hole in the end of the cannon, and then with a lighted piece of punk, they'd fire the cannon. This was an artilleryman's horn. That's why it's so large, and it had to be refilled constantly. Incidentally, this is interesting because this man here lost his arm at the siege of Bag of Deuce up in Castine, Maine. From then on, he hunted and worked with only one arm, and you can see where his teeth had bit this here horn when he held it under his arm. Both on it, he's got tooth marks on it.